You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. My guest in this episode is Catherine Imabayashi. I'm patting myself on the back here because, believe it or not, I actually pronounced that very beautiful name correctly on my first try when we did this interview. Catherine shares with me the story of how reading a book changed her life. So go ahead before we get too far and make your personal guesses what you think the life-changing book might have been. I'm going to go ahead and tell you that I did not guess correctly playing the same game, but maybe you will. We talk about what the book was and how it changed her life. This is a wonderful story, and I think you're really going to love it. So let's get to it. Catherine Imabayashi, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I am. I'm excited to be with you. Thank you for having me.
I'm so happy. So in a second, we're going to start the topic of the day. But before we do, I have a warm-up question. The saying is that laughter is the best medicine. So my question is, what is something that you can count on to bring you a smile or a laugh?
My son.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I get that a lot as an answer. I've been doing this question as a warm-up question for the last couple of shows, and several people have said that. I love that. I actually normally, to get to the topic of the day, we're going to talk about once upon a time, you read a book that went on to change the course of your life. Those are the words you put on the form. The first question I ask has got to be, what was this book?
James Clavell, Shogun.
Oh my goodness. You know, I was thinking in my mind, like what it would be and all the things that it could be. And that was not anywhere on my list. All right. Shogun. I love it. Usually I begin my interviews by asking people where they are. And I didn't ask you that because where you are is maybe a part of the story. It made more sense to do it here. So tell us where you live today and also share with us where you grew up.
Well, I grew up in Canada, stayed there for the first 30 years. Then I read the book, came to Japan, stayed here for 19 years, and then kind of changed careers or a part of my career for the next 10 years, and then came back to Japan. We've retired very close to where I started.
Beautiful. All right. I'm looking forward to unpacking this. You actually just answered one of my questions that I had, so I'm very excited about this. But you shared with me that what you were doing was you were traveling across Canada when you, I guess, were reading Shogun. Can you share with us a little bit more about what was going on in your life at that time? Like what brought you to traveling around in Canada?
I started out I grew up in Nova Scotia, which is on the east coast of Canada. I went to, or I started university in Newfoundland, which was going as far east as you could go. And I was going into social work. And just as fate would have it, but I didn't realize it at the time, something happened with finances and I only completed my first semester. So then I searched for a plan B. And at the time it was like, get your teacher's license because that'll, you know, and then figure out what your next steps are. So I did that. At the time, you could teach for 2 years to get your permanent license. And then that was it for life. So I stayed in Nova Scotia, 2 years, permanent license. And then I just knew I wanted to go. I didn't know. I really didn't know what I was going to do. So I went, I went to Ontario for a while. Then I went to Alberta, stayed there for a year and started working in daycare and fell in love with that, really fell in love with that. And so I moved from Calgary to Vancouver, which is as far west as you can go. And I stayed there for just a little more than 6 years. And it was at that and loved it and continued to work in daycare and loved it. But I also knew I felt something. I was unsettled. I was not grounded. And that's kind of, I didn't know if it was just, you know, the 30s thing, you know, coming up, or I really didn't know what, but I knew that I wasn't on the path that was going to bring me peace and joy and all the good things in life. And it was a Christmas holiday, the last year that I was in Vancouver, so the sixth year perhaps. And I went to a secondhand store because I wanted something to read over the holidays. And I picked up that book, James Clavell Shogun, just as some entertainment over the holidays. And I mean, I fell in love with his writing and his style, and I read all his other stuff, but it wasn't the book. It definitely was not the book. It was, it spoke to me like nothing I had ever, it had never happened to me before. And there was such a knowing that it was like, well, I have to go to Japan. And I can't say that I questioned it. It was just a knowing. And it's like, but before that, I had no interest, no knowledge, no experience with anything Japanese. Like that wasn't part of my world at all. So I bought a book because internet was not a thing in those days, and
Right.
got a book. It was called Jobs in Japan. I sent out a bunch of letters to places because although I knew I was going to go, I needed the security of a job because I didn't have any connections. I got a job, and within 3 months, like it was, I ended up leaving Canada the end of March, beginning of April of the following year, and came to Japan, 2 year contract, stayed 19 years the first time around, and that's how it all started.
I love this. It is an amazing book. It is an
It
amazing book,
is.
Shogun. And I went through a phase at some point in my life. They're great summer reads, but he's done several. I forget all the titles, but I definitely went through at one point like a binge of reading his
Me too.
epic tales. And then also, I have a very clear memory of at some point in the 80s in my childhood, they made the mini series of Shogun. And this was before DVDs. It was before streaming, and I was much too young to have watched this on television, but it was such a show-stopping series that I ended up watching it because my father was watching it. And so I think back to that and I'm like, oh, probably it was not age appropriate for someone my age to be watching that. But it was on, and there was no way to do it. I also watched the epic tales of Dallas with my family, which was equally inappropriate at that point. But you know, that was life at that point. If the TV was on and you were in the room, you were watching it. There was no other choice. All right, so you read Shogun, spectacular. And so you were it. So how old were you? How long ago was this when you made the first trip?
I just turned 30.
You just turned 30 when you did that. All right. So, and it was the culture of Japan and the story of Japan that attracted you, not anything else, just the story.
No, it's just strange. It wasn't the story. I had no desire. It was not a pull to come to this culture. And if I was being pulled, I thought I was going to Africa at some point in my
Okay.
life. That's where I felt I was going. There was not that pull. It was more, and it sounds flaky, I guess, when I say it, but it was a message in the book that I felt. I didn't see it. I didn't hear it. I just felt this. Okay, this is the nudge. This is where I'm supposed to go. Didn't know why,
Really?
but
Okay.
it was just a nudge.
All right. Very, very good. Okay. So then the practical steps you took, because this is a massive move. This is a massive move. You're 30 years old and you don't speak the language, but you find, I guess, basically an agency or a book or some sort of thing that has, here's how you apply for a job. Like, what are the other things that you did?
It was actually called Jobs in Japan. That was the name of the book, and it told you about some of the particulars of working in Japan at that time. And at the back of the book was a list of schools because it was people
How
who
to
were looking
teach.
for English teaching jobs.
Yeah. And so what else did you have to do? What were some of the other, because you had a life in Vancouver at this point. So what are some of the other things that you had to do to close up shop and move thousands of miles? Do you remember?
I
was a long
didn't think
time.
so much about it. Like
Okay.
I just didn't think about it. Had a couple of yard sales, got rid of
Okay.
everything. I came to Japan with two suitcases. I had two cats, but it was my understanding that that would have been difficult to bring them. So I found good friends to take them and adopt them. And it wasn't difficult. I was renting, so I didn't have to worry about, all those particulars of turning the gas off or whatever. I just said I was, moving out the following month, closed my bank account, sold my car. It was just,
Okay.
it wasn't difficult. And I think one of the easiest things was that because I think it just would have been so different today, because there was no internet. So I waited until I had confirmation of the job. And that confirmation came, and then I had to be there soon after that. And I sent a letter to my family.
So
So
that was the next question. So this is the next question, right? Because once upon a time, I moved from New York to Florida, which is a fraction of what you did. And even that, my family was like, well, we don't know. There was like, it wasn't like, don't do it, but there was some pushback. So I definitely was going to ask, like, what the people who are in your life at the time, whatever your support is. And this is our first conversation. Like, I didn't know what your family and your connections and things were like, but the people who were in your life, like, how did they respond?
I don't really remember feeling responses. I wasn't asking for feedback. I was just saying, I have an air ticket and I'm relocating to Japan and I'll contact you as soon as I can. It wasn't there was no I wasn't looking for guidance or discussion. It's such a different time because you didn't expect immediate responses. You weren't waiting for someone's opinion to sway you one way or the other. It was like, okay, this is what happened. Not really sure why, but I've got a feeling I'm supposed to go to Japan, so off I go. And that was it.
That's amazing. All right, so you send your family a letter. Did they get it before you like left? Like, did they know before? Was it sort of like they crossed in the mail while you were over the ocean?
I can't remember
Okay.
to be because I thought about that beforehand. Again, at that time, like we didn't have cell phones, didn't
Right.
have I didn't have a phone like where I was renting. It wasn't important to me to have a phone, so there was none of that. I do remember when I first came to Japan, I had to figure out or try to figure out how to use international phones, like in a phone box.
Yep.
To a phone booth and to call them. I know as soon as I got there and was settled, I called them to say I was there. But that's kind of it, really. It was after I got settled that we started, really regular, monthly letters or something like that.
That is amazing. Okay, so you moved to Japan, you're going to teach English, but you don't speak Japanese. Did you go on since then? You've been there quite a while. Have you gone on to pick up quite a bit of Japanese? Do you speak Japanese at this point?
If you had asked me before I retired, I would have said, "Yeah, I'm pretty good. I can get by and everything, and my conversational Japanese is fine. Like I can talk to people outside." But I think my husband and I have maybe created some kind of our own language. And now that we're retired and we're just together more often, it's like, I don't know how we stayed together so long because when we're both trying to communicate more. So my Japanese is not where it should be for the length of time that I've lived here, but I can get by.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I don't. I it, it. Yeah. I've heard that it takes a lot of work because to pick up any of the languages that have a completely different alphabet. Like,
It's
so
hard.
when they're not rooted, because you don't have any of the crossover skills. It's not even like you can mispronounce the words and sign them out. It's
Yeah.
like it's a whole other level of challenge. So that is very good. All right. So. Some of this you've told us very directly, but I'm going to ask it again to go through. I tried to be a good little journalist and go through your website and piece together the time frame, but I didn't want to make any assumptions about what you had done. So you moved to Japan and you stayed there for, I think, 19 years, you said.
19 years, yeah.
Right. And then would you say that what you were doing then is building like sort of a forever life there, or like did you is like you had a job, you is that when you got married, like, or what are some of the other things that happened at that time? How did this come together?
Well, I came here in 85. I got married in 92.
Okay.
I met my husband a year or so after I moved here. Just we were kind of in a same circle that got together like once a month or something like that. And he was a friend for years before we started a relationship. When we did decide that we were going to get married, I knew and I had said that, I was fine to stay in Japan for a while, but that I was not going to retire here. I was not going to die here. That,
Okay.
we would be moving someplace else. I didn't know, details, but we had had that conversation.
You had had that conversation. And then there's a break. So you're in Japan now, but there's a break. Did you move to other countries or did you come home to Canada?
No, I haven't lived in Canada since 1985.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So when we left here when our son finished elementary school, and this international school is the only one on this part of the island, and it was beautiful for his elementary years, but it was too small for his personality, and so like there weren't that he needed more arts, more sports, more friends, that kind of a situation. So again, like I could go through my whole life and say this happened, but it shouldn't have happened. Like everything, like there's really a lot of fate-driven experiences that have come about. But when he was finished elementary, we moved. I got a job in Beirut, Lebanon, and we went there for his middle school and high school, and that was a really beautiful experience. And challenging as well. When he left, when he graduated and he was going to move to Canada for university, that was very difficult for me. He was an only child, center of the world, he takes big space, and I wasn't quite sure how I would deal with that. Up until that point, I had been in the classroom. I'm an educator and I'd been in the classroom for my career. And I decided that once he left, then I would move into administration, and because I knew that that would be draining. And so I moved into administration. First job I got was in Bangkok in Thailand, and we spent 2 years there. Then I got a job in Tbilisi, Georgia, and spent a year there. Then got a job to open up a school in Qatar in Doha. And there was a lot of experiences that were showing me my heart beats faster when I am in education, not business. Like
Okay.
I understand people, I understand children. So it was challenging in a lot of ways. When Doha finished, I needed to make a decision, and I had two job offers, and one was in Tokyo and one was in Moscow. And the adventuresome part of me was like, "Oh, I haven't been to Russia. Maybe I'll do that." But then, after a little bit of research, and it was like, okay, maybe Tokyo is, it felt right. The connections I had with the people who were offering the job felt right. So I went to Tokyo for 3 years. And then I knew I maybe had one more in me. And I really wanted to get back into an educational institution that was not for profit. That business was not the driving factor. And so I got a job in Hiroshima in an international school and finished off my 2 years there, and then retired where I am right now in Itoshima.
What an amazing journey. Oh my goodness. Yeah, this was so when I was poking around, I was like, all right, so was this a singular move? Like, it would be a dramatic story if it's just one move, Vancouver to Japan and new life in Japan. But that's not what you did. It was really the beginning of a very, very international sequence of moves, which is, did you, were you, I mean, you said earlier that when you were younger in Canada and you were building the frame for your life, that you felt, I'm trying to remember the word you used, I think a little bit unsettled, like this was not the final path. Were you aware of this desire to explore and visit places that I would put in the category of some of them are kind of exotic locations? This is not, pedestrian. It's not everybody picks up and moves to Lebanon and Beirut.
I think it's important to remember the context of the time. So it was a little bit rebellious to leave Nova Scotia and move within Canada. There wasn't the world was smaller or bigger. The world was bigger. It's quite small now. So there wasn't really that, it never entered my head that, I could go to all these different places. Like it wasn't it wasn't part of the what the choices were at the time that I knew of.
So that's a beautiful way to begin to talk about this because simultaneously, it was not anything that you could possibly have imagined or were imagining. You pick up a book, there's a choice there. You felt a call to go, but many people would have felt it and just talked about it with their friend at the coffee shop and not actually filled out the form. What were the things, and this is not a great question, but if you remember, like thinking back at these times, these choice times where you have a choice, like, hey, I could, because not doing something is a choice. What would you say is the thing that you're like, oh, let's try it? Like, where's your mindset where you're like, let me see what happens and what explores? How do you put yourself in that spot and why do you make the decision to jump?
I think rather than jumping to, it was jumping from. I
Okay.
knew without any doubt in my heart, I knew that if I stayed on the path that I was in, it would not end up well for me. Like I was hanging out with maybe people that weren't bringing out the best in me or, partying a little bit too much, just being unsettled and not grounded and floundering. It just felt like, so I knew if I stayed, I would continue to flounder and probably make choices that weren't going to serve me well for the rest of my life.
I think that that's a really excellent context because in the world of self-help, there's a lot of pressure to like sort of visualize like the better version of yourself. And yet I talk to people all the time who they don't have an idea of what the better version of themselves is. And so then, you can internalize that and be like, well, obviously there's something wrong with me that I can't figure this out. But I think it's very reasonable to say, all I know is that if I stay this, stay with what I'm doing, it's not going to work out the way I want. So why not try this other thing? That's an amazing context. An amazing. Did the people when you were growing up, did people describe you as a risk taker or a rebellious sort of person who did adventuresome things?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I was shy, quiet. No, I was not a risk taker.
What did your crew? So I know we talked about your family. And you mailed them a letter that you were leaving. But the people who are in your social circle, as you were making these plans, when you were like, I'm going to move to Japan, what did people say?
I don't remember anything negative. I think part of that was just that I was not looking for, it's not that I didn't care, but I made a decision. I was doing it. I was just letting my close circle know. And if they wanted to wish me well, which most of them did, because
Okay.
a lot of people would be, oh, that's really adventuresome. I couldn't do that. So it was more, I got more kudos for it than, do you think
Okay.
you're doing the right thing, kind of.
I think that shows a lot about your circle of friends, because a lot of times when I'm not asking for permission, people still will volunteer what they think I should do. And I find myself thinking, I didn't ask,
Yeah.
Thanks, but I didn't ask. So I wondered, that's the reason I pushed a little bit on that, because I was like, I don't know. The people I hang out with, even if I don't ask them for their opinion, sometimes they share it anyway.
Yeah,
Especially
yeah.
when it comes to and you started your family in Japan, not before you left,
Yes.
right? Okay. So especially though when it comes to decisions about families and children, that is a particular place where strangers sometimes, at least in the United States, feel free to volunteer their opinions about the things that we do.
Well, I would say that there was more resistance when I said that we were leaving Japan and going to Beirut.
I can
And that
imagine.
was completely out of fear. But none of my family made me feel guilty for making that decision. And but they were worried. There was real concern there.
Yes. I mean, it's a part of the world that definitely has a lot of mystique and uncertainty, and people don't, it's not necessarily. It's a very distinct outsider impression. I'm not an expert in Lebanon, but there's, it's one of those things that, when you go, they're like, really? So all right. So the many like many people, it sounds to me when I read your resume and the things that you had written on your blog about yourself, it sounds like at least parts of your profession, not all, because you were already rooted in social work and education, but parts of your profession have been very much informed and affected by your personal experience. You are a parent, and you are a retired educator who now helps raise what you could say call emotionally healthy boys. So, at what point did this become a passion of yours? And tell us more about why that's important to you.
Again, another fate driven experience. So I was an older mom when, or they call it a mature mom, when our son was born, and he was a bit of a miracle child to begin with. And I had already been working in early years and early education for quite some time. So I felt quite confident in some areas of bringing a child into the world. I was less confident about raising a boy because I'd been raised mostly with girls but I was thrilled when it was a boy. So I'm very curious about a lot of stuff, and I read, all the books that were available at the time about, raising children, and they were very good for those, especially the younger years. And so I was confident. And I had grown up in the 60s, and that was the women's movement. And so I was a very strong, independent female as a young adult and into the rest of my womanhood. And I thought that I didn't have any biases connected with anything, actually. They were things I thought about, but I didn't think I had biases about gender or race, or like it wasn't part of my world. When our son was somewhere between 3 and 4, on a Saturday, his dad was working and he wanted to go fishing, and which means a little plastic fishing rod. And so we did. We went, he and I went to this little creek that was a little bit, in the woods, but I was in Japan. I never feared for personal safety. So we went there, and it was down a path to get to the creek. And we set ourselves up, and it was a beautiful day, and it was lovely. Like, we were having a really lovely time. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw a group of 5 or 6 boys coming down the path. And my first instinct was like real fear, real fear. And it was, okay, there's a gang of boys coming down. How am I going to protect my son and myself? And that was the first, without any thought, automatic response.
Do you remember, can I pause just a second and ask you, do you remember how old the boys were in the group, roughly?
Well, yes, like that's kind of what
Okay.
happened was so they came down and it was obvious as soon as they got a little bit closer. At that particular time, I was teaching upper elementary. So I had just been working with the same age group as these boys coming down, but it was far enough into the summer months. That summer between elementary school and middle school is usually when a lot of boys, their bodies, they just have growth spurts that are, wild. So their bodies were bigger coming down than the boys that I remember in the classroom. And,
Okay.
but they were, like 12.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
12 going on to 13. So they came down. They were sweet. We had a great time with them. My son loved being with the big boys and they were so good with him. And we just had a wonderful time. So we went home that night at the end when the day was all finishing and I was by myself and I started to think about it and it was like, why did I react that way? Where did that feeling come from? Why did I get so scared so automatically when like there was nothing logical about it? And I searched and searched. I had like, why did it trigger me?
Yeah.
I have no experiences with violence. I could not pinpoint anything logical. And it was really bothering me because when I have a question, I like to find the answer. And I was about to let it go, at least for that night. And I had a thought, and that's what happened. When I thought, okay, my little guy is 3, 4 right now. In 10 years or 15 years or 20, and even when every time I say this, I get a chill. Is he going to cause that sense of fear in another woman? Is a woman who meets him on the street going to change to the other side of the street because she's filled with fear? And she's filled with fear because he was born a boy, not because of the clothes he's got on, not because anything he's saying or he's doing, simply because he was born a boy. And that just broke my heart. And I thought, something's wrong with this picture, and I am going to find out why this is the way it is. And then what can I do about it? First for my son, and then for all, I work with little boys. I'm in a
Yeah.
classroom. Half of them are little boys. So that was the starting point, and it's been 28 years now.
So, have you ever read the book, Michael Fitzgerald, I think is the author, Raising Cain?
Oh, really? Well, it's one of the first books I read, yeah.
Yeah. No, I read that when my stepson was in elementary school, and it was I'm not, it was either given to us by a family friend or by my husband's by his mom, my stepson's mom, but it touches a little bit, not directly on the exact same issues, but it is very much about like the realities of having a very and it's been a long time since I've read it, so you might have a better memory of it than I do, but the realities of young boys in education with a very female-led teaching staff and administration staff that is perhaps making judgments and creating situations that where they it doesn't reflect the real behaviors of the boy. It doesn't give them space to not face consequences for boyish behavior. I think it's an interesting concept. It's an old book, but
Yes, it is.
still worth reading. And it's definitely and. It's my experience just as a person is very similar to yours that there is a phase where children shift in how they are appearing to others from small children to maybe small adults and it doesn't necessarily match the actual capacity
Yeah.
and of the kids. So you have people, they look older than they behave. And especially if kids grow fast. So if you have a young I'll say boy just because we're talking about your son, but if you have a young boy who grows really fast and is really still quite young, and then people will make judgments like, well, why is this kid behaving in such a juvenile way? Because they're assuming that he's older than he is. And you find yourself in a position, you're like, well, they're five.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking of when you were saying
Yeah.
that is in kindergarten, because I've had boys like that were the youngest boys in the room, but they were tall, they were
They're
big
tall,
boys.
yeah.
And the expectation for behavior for them because of their size just was, not realistic and didn't match what they were capable of being successful at.
Yeah, we had a family friend whose son was very, very tall at a very young age. And so at barbecues and parties, people who didn't know him would think that
Yeah.
he was, and they would make what was kind of crazy statements. And you'd find yourself saying, he's five.
Yeah.
He's
Yeah.
five. This is absolutely age appropriate. So it is a very interesting thing. It's interesting that that you followed that path. And I think so. And one of the things that you're reflecting, you had so much experience as a professional in an administrative and an academic, like in a classroom and all of these things with students of all different kinds. But I always love to give people a chance to reflect on the lived experience as a parent then. Like, how could you describe the difference of actually going through it that changed the way you looked at this type of person?
I was sure there was no difference. I was positive before I had a child that because I worked so closely with children and their families, and I thought that I understood. And I would have fought you if you said
Yeah.
that I didn't understand. It was like I understood. And then I had a child. And what I can say is that, yes, I understood from my perspective, but I had no concept, and I don't think anybody can until they actually have a child. I couldn't understand what it feels like to have this human being that I'm responsible for 24 hours a day, every day of his whole life. And I didn't understand that fierce sense of love and the fierce sense of protection. I could not have really understood that in any other way than having a child.
Yeah, it's and I call this the hill I might die on, and I expand it out past parenthood because I think there's a myriad of experiences where we hear this same story. For example, the surgeon who thinks that they understand what it's like to be a patient until they are a patient, right? And then they're like, oh wow, bedside manner is actually very important. Oh look, this hurts. So what I call it the hill I might die on is just really the value of lived experience. In addition to perhaps study and professional experience can sometimes be. And so like, giving weight and credence to people who have gone through experiences to lend their stories to help us guide us through the experience. Like, so I say, I'm like, I will always ask when I'm giving somebody advice and they're telling me how to do something, I'm like, so wait, have you done this? That's
Yeah,
my
actually, I started my book saying basically the same thing. It's like if I want advice about raising dogs and someone is going to give me advice, if they haven't had their own dog, their opinion has a limit to the credibility and value that I'm going to give it.
Yeah, and I think that that's very well said. It's not that the other is not valid or it's sometimes very important and very helpful. It's just sometimes a different lens and a different context. Very early on in my coaching experience, I ran into somebody who had worked as a social worker when she was child-free. Child-free. And she said, I went into these houses and had huge authority to make decisions about their family. And I thought I knew. And then many years went by and I had lived my family. And she said, if I went back to those situations, I'd have a completely different perspective, having been put in that spot. And I think it's an interesting spot to be. Okay, so in a minute we're going to do the final questions, but I want to give you a chance to talk directly about what you are doing these days, and how people can connect and follow you online.
Well, my website is sonhoodcoaching.com and Son, sonhood. And on the website, there's links to my book, there's links to social media, I think there's a link to my podcast. Everything that that's the starting point for anything that you want to know. I've got articles on there. I've got about what my story is, what I do. So what I have lots of online courses. I've got a community. It's kind of whatever you're looking for, you might be able to find it there. The biggest thing that I love doing more than anything else is coaching. I love having one-on-ones with people who are kind of in turmoil, and there's chaos in their world, and I just find it so gratifying to help a family be able to connect and just find that real joy in being a family. So that's where my heart kind of flows.
Very nice. All right. So the links, for anybody who's listening, they'll be in the show notes. And the easiest way to get the links, is to be subscribed to the Imperfect Adulting email community, because then I send it directly to your email box and you can just click on it and you can find the information and connect with Catherine. So, can you, do you think that, I don't always ask this question because I don't think it's always productive to say, hey, would you have done it differently if you had, if you knew now, if you knew then what you know now, would you have done it differently? But in this case, do you ever stop and wonder if you had not read Shogun, if you would have probably taken a jump, if you might have taken a jump and begun your international adventures?
I kind of think when I am on the path that's right for me at that particular stage in my life, then everything falls in place.
Okay.
And when I'm not on the right path, I keep hitting blocks, hitting doors. So if I hadn't listened to that voice telling me to go to Japan, I think I probably would have stayed in Canada for at least, the next foreseeable, number of years. But I know I would have continued to hit walls over and over and over again.
Okay. Yeah. And then you think that something would have, there would have been a different book or a different message or an invitation in some other way that would have pushed you on the journey. And then, and so you moved and it was a 2-year term and you stayed for 19 years. And what, and then it was the search for a new school for your son that pushed you to make another jump. Yeah, and begin the journeys. And then it sounds like there have been many, many shorter things. It's such an amazing geographic resume.
It's been so much fun. Like, I mean, there's been a lot of challenges, but it's just been a fun adventure. No regrets.
Could you have imagined, even in the wildest dreams, when you were about 10 years old, that you would be standing here, sitting here today, talking to me across the world about all of the variety of amazing experiences and places that you've lived?
No, that was not in my, it was not on my vision board. Like, no.
No, and amazing. All right, now, Catherine, are you ready for the final questions, the fun questions?
I am ready.
Are very good. These are just for fun. They're supposed to, just come pop up with whatever pops in your mind. Okay, so because you are a nomad and you've lived in all of these places, the first thing that I thought of as a question was, I was curious if there is a food or tradition from your childhood home in Canada that you occasionally miss.
Food isn't, food is a whole other story in my world, but the one food that was is still kind of warms my heart is my sister, was kind of famous for her meal of homemade Caesar salad and spaghetti with homemade sauce. And anytime that I was in the same city that she was in, that would be the meal that was just kind of, oh yeah, I'm home.
Okay. All right. Very good. Very, because the food is so dramatically different in the places that you have
Oh,
lived as an
yes.
adult than where you grew up. And it's a rule that when you're talking to somebody who grew up in Canada, you have to give them a chance to talk about, what is the French fries and gravy thing called? I
That
forget.
wasn't a thing when I was there.
Oh, that's a new thing?
Yes.
Ah, I
The first
didn't
time
know
I
that.
heard it, I couldn't believe it. I thought, what?
Like,
Yes,
yes.
no, that was not. I never heard of that when I was living in Canada.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. All right. I didn't know that. Now I have learned. All right. Very good. This question has two parts. Do you prefer to read books these days or listen to audiobooks? That's the first part. And then the next thing is, do you want to share what maybe the last thing you read or listened to was?
I listen to a lot of things because I always seem to be striving for more time. So
Okay.
I will, mix those things together. But I love reading a physical book because I think I associate that with holidays. Like that's my ideal holiday is to sit on the beach and, devour a couple of books in a couple of weeks. And so both. The most recent book. Oh, what was it called? I'm reading one right now. I usually have a few books on the go, and the book that I am reading on my Kindle, I got it because I had interviewed the woman for something else, and it's her name is Laura Bosica, and she writes the Chronicles of the Bluebells of Scotland or something like that. But it's historical fiction, and I love historical fiction. So that's the one I'm reading with that. And then the other one, the one I just finished was oh, the Anxious Generation.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And that was kind of whew.
Yeah, that
So
one's
yeah.
it's not a feel good read.
No, but there was some good information, like trying to make sense of the current world and what people are having to deal with that are, young people in the world or young people having children and growing up in this world. Like it was a good, it was an important book, I think.
Very nice, very good. Okay, so you may have already given away the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Imagine that it's a Saturday, a day where you have a totally empty calendar, no clients and no obligations or responsibilities in your day. What would you probably be doing if we peeked in and saw you as a visitor? Would you be curled up on the couch reading? Would you be watching TV? Would you be doing crafts or a puzzle, socializing with friends, or something totally different?
You wouldn't find me at home if it was the beginning of the day, and I live in a beautiful natural environment, so I'd be out for a couple of hours walking in the woods and along the water, and I would be listening to some motivational, inspirational podcast that was just filling my soul.
Beautiful, beautiful. That's it, Catherine. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thank you for having me. This was a really fun conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again. Please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.